I used to go to church, but the church didn't quench my thirst. Mama taught me to put God first, but she never tried to block my search. I was curious, young but serious. Why is religion so mysterious? Why is black life so hard? They say you're not supposed to question God. Well, is it okay to question the pastor? Was it passed down from the slave master? It was only the truth I was after, but I never could get a straight answer. So I couldn't relate to the sermon. Put down the Bible, then I start learning about life. Didn't know where the path would lead, but I had to get off my knees.
All right. Thank you guys for tuning in to another episode of the Corner of My Mind podcast. So today in my new verse, the first thing I wanted to talk about is one, Obama, President McBlackie. That's what they call him out there in some arenas. But this very intelligent president has decided to open up political negotiations and diplomatic relationships with Cuba, something that has never worked, and that has been the trade embargo of Cuba, has never worked. And so what he's decided in order to open up business between these two countries, create some business opportunities for businesses in the United States, as well as abroad, was to throw away this old guard, part of the old thinking of trying to basically isolate Cuba. And by isolating Cuba, the hope was to someday get Cuba to become a democratic, democratic republic. And that never worked. And it was never going to work because you're basically trying to say, well, if you don't play it my way, then you don't get to play at all. And so it didn't work. And so what he decided, he said, hey, this whole de facto trade embargo with Cuba. And basically, America had the arrogant attitude of that they forced other countries to say, okay, well, if you want to play ball with us in our arena, then you don't play ball with Cuba. And so, therefore, you had this kind of like de facto world embargo against Cuba, although other nations, countries out there did not have an official policy of an embargo. But because everyone wanted to make sure they maintained a positive relationship with the United States, they adhered to, what United States did and didn't engage in any type of trade with Cuba, except for, I think it is Russia and China. Of course, the two countries that we say that we are not on great relationships with, although we do a lot of trading with them anyway. So go figure that out. So it's official. We are beginning diplomatic relationships with Cuba. And again, this is going to be huge. You know, in the last 2 years, the business sector, who is typically votes Republican, can't do anything or can't say anything negative against them because this means money for them. And that's pretty much all the Republican Party and people like the Koch brothers. This is what they understand. And this is what he's given them. And so they're not going to be able to turn away from it. They can't turn away from any opportunity to make any kinds of money. So it also means not only just, being for American business to do trade with Cuba, because the Cuban population is very, very familiar with the different types of brands, as far as purchasing is concerned over here in the United States. But also because of this embargo, Cuba has been in this kind of like time warp with respect to its infrastructure. So a lot of its roads need to be rebuilt. So that means they can be able to trade and maybe get some companies in there to do a lot of infrastructure development with respect to electricity, with respect to cell phone, cellular technology, as well as with respect to kind of like modernizing their whole architecture in that country. So this is very huge because with respect to roads and cars, there are a lot of vintage cars over in the country of Cuba because though Cuba couldn't receive any new cars from the United States and some of the other countries that were in positive relationships with the United States. So they have a large bevy of cars that are date back to the 1950s and 60s that people keep them in condition because they don't have any other choice but to keep those cars running because there are no new cars coming in that country. So this is going to be huge, huge, huge. So just wait in the next year or so, we'll be able to travel to Cuba. That's what my money is banking on. So stay tuned for more from President Obama and with Cuba from love. Anyway, moving on to the next. All right. So the next thing I want to talk about is big news, and it's also causing Republicans a lot of problems dealing with this issue because they don't like the concept of anything free. Even though many of them come from a generation that they have benefited from a lot of free or low cost things. And that is, Obama has proposed that American students will be able to receive a 2-year college or some type of certification from a business school paid free, as long as you go into a 2-year college. So this is what it would do. It would, one, it would save students on average of about $3,800 per year in tuition, from what I understand. It would also benefit more than 9 million students. I'm betting it's going to benefit more than 9 million students. Because what it's going to do, in my opinion, is, and from what I can see, is that the money is being directed at junior colleges, you know, 2-year institutions, you know, your local junior colleges. So what's going to happen is that a lot of people are going to say, hey, who fall into the same economic strata that would benefit from Pell Grant monies. These same individuals will probably be the first ones who qualify for these types of for having 2 years of college education paid for by the government and the states. And so what you're going to do is what's going to happen is that a lot of individuals are going to forego going to more and more people are going to forego going to 4-year institutions right off the bat and start at the junior college, because that means I can go here, get all of my because most of the first 2 years that you are in college, you're fulfilling the first 2 semesters with a lot of prerequisite classes anyway before you actually get into your major. So a lot of students, what I think is going to happen is a lot of students are just going to go to the junior colleges, fill their first, 60 hours, and then transfer those 60 hours to a 4-year school and finish if they're actually going for a degree. But it also allows students who are also in programs that are occupational training type programs that would be, I guess, on par with a 2-year associate's degree or 2-year certification type of program. So this is huge. And a lot of people are bemoaning. A lot of people are talking about how it's just a bunch of more free stuff, or people who want free stuff, or people who are always crying that the government is not doing enough. But also it's going to decrease the numbers of people who are on the rolls, the large number of people who are going into default on their student loans. And that's a big, big thing. I think that's one of the big drivers here, that, you know, the student loan debt has gotten out of control and the government doesn't know what to do. And there's actually been a huge campaign over the last 3 or 4 years where people working trying to get the government to forgive this huge national debt of student loans. I'm not sure if it's going to be if they're trying to do all student loans or if they're trying to do certain student loans that are of a certain age. But the bottom line is most people who study the economy, most people who study finance say something needs to happen, because this student loan debt situation could end up being the next, you know, housing market burst, bubble being burst, or it could be the next big, like we had with the fall of the, Wall Street, you know, back in 2007, 2008. So this is huge. This is very big. And what it's going to mean, like I said, it's going to be about $3,800 per student per year. It's going to benefit more than 9 million students. I think that's going to increase dramatically once this goes into effect. Students will have to maintain a 2.5 GPA to continue to qualify, and there will have to be a minimum of a half-time student, as well as show some sort of progress towards getting, towards completing this. And what I imagine this means is going to be some type of benchmarks that they're going to have to set for each student to show in order to determine show progress, because anybody can say they're progressing just by taking a class. But I imagine, you know, by keeping this 2.5 and constantly being in class and working towards that degree on a consistent basis is probably going to be somehow factored into that. But I can't wait. I'm glad to see it's coming. It harkens back to a time in the 70s, late 60s, 70s, and early 80s, up through the Clinton era, and when Reagan, up through, I guess, Reagan's era, where you had so many students come out of college who had absolutely no debt whatsoever. College education, college tuition, which was much more extremely subsidized by the federal government because, and this goes back to another topic that we don't have time for, but the rich in this country at one point was taxed up to as much as 90% of their income. It means 90% of their income was available to be taxed, whereas so much of the income, such a small portion now of the top 5% wage earners in this country are not taxed because of different types of tax loopholes, ways they can invest to hide money for temporarily and not be taxed or be taxed later. The government, they're not paying their fair share of taxes. And when they were paying their fair share of taxes, this doesn't happen. We have more innovation. We have more people graduating from college. We had just a much more, I guess, you know, a large level of happiness, I think, because people were able to do the things they needed to do. And more innovation came because more people were graduating from college and not worried about taking any kind of job just to pay their student loans. So look forward to this coming in the next year or so. Obama will probably be out of college before, out of the office, should I say, before it all gets instituted. But I believe he's going to set this in motion. And I don't think the people are going to turn away from this, because just like affordable health care, this is another good, good thing for the country. All right. So that's been my kind of like brief news announcements for the first part of this podcast. So stay tuned. In a moment, I'll be back with the more deeper issue that I want to discuss today. All right. Thank you so much for hanging in there with me. I know there are other things you could have done, other things you could have been doing with your time, but I do appreciate you hanging in there and hanging in there with me on this podcast and coming back for part two. So this next part, I want to talk about an issue that has really gained a lot of traction in the last 3 to 4 months. This issue that people are calling, at one point, some people call it, were calling it, people who do this call them culture vultures, or another young lady by the name of Azalea Banks, who's a hip hop artist on the rise, called the concept cultural smudging. So I want you to take a listen to this interview that she did a little while back, maybe a couple of months back, at a well-known radio station up in New York, Hot 97, with radio personality.
I feel just like in this country, like just in this country, whenever it comes to our things like black issues or black politics or black music or whatever, there's always this like undercurrent of kind of like a fuck you. There's always like a fuck y'all niggas. Like y'all don't really own shit. Like y'all don't have shit. You get what I'm saying?
Yes.
And that Macklemore album wasn't better than the Drake record.
And Macklemore admitted his album wasn't better than Kendrick.
You know what I mean? That Iggy Azalea shit is not better than any fucking black girl that's rapping today, you know? And when they give those awards out, because the Grammys are supposed to be like accolades for artistic excellence. You get what I mean? Iggy Azalea is not excellent, you know? And the message I see when I see these Grammys being given out, like these, because it's bigger than just like playing the shit on the radio and I don't give a fuck. You know what I mean? Like, that's fine, bitch. Like, do what you're going to do. But it's, I have a problem when you're trying to like say that it's hip hop and you're trying to like put it like up against black culture. Like even like, you know, like Nicki Minaj over the past two, three, 4 years has done so much to kind of create this like social presence and this like hold on just like, you know, like social consciousness. And then here you go, like, okay, so she's like re-up and Roman Reloaded, then you got fucking Iggy like reclassified. Like you're trying to smudge out. You know what I mean? It's like you're trying to like, it's like a cultural smudging is what I see. And when they give these Grammys out, all it says to white kids is like, oh yeah, you're great. You're amazing. You can do whatever you put your mind to. And it says to black kids, you don't have shit. You don't own shit. Not even the shit you created for yourself. And it makes me upset in that
way. And you know what? I think there is some conscious people who do that. Like I believe what you're saying. But I also believe a majority of people aren't conscious. We just finished having a conversation about it, where people purchase and put their money next to things that they see themselves in, right? It's been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
Right? And it's really a marketing thing. It's psychology, right? Where 64% of the United States is white. Right.
And that's fine. Well, look. Well,
and I'm just saying that they purchase things that they see themselves in. Right. And businesses capitalize on that.
And that's fine. So put her in the pop category. Put her with Katy Perry and Lady. Put her and Miley Cyrus in the same fucking box together.
Don't put her in hip hop.
Don't put her in hip hop.
But she's rapping over a beat, though.
But just because she's not singing does not mean it's rap music.
I didn't know the level of cultural appropriation we were watching at the time. And by the way, I don't blame Iggy for that personally. But in terms of her then being embraced and Fancy becoming the quintessential rap song,
I mean,
that sucks.
But this ain't the first time. But this ain't the first time. And so what I say to this and what I always look at it is don't y'all know the drill? All right.
All right. Look.
And you and like I like I understand. Well, let me finish. I understand what you're saying. Right. We've seen hip hop go pop several times.
Can I interject?
Go ahead.
Okay. Now everybody knows that like the basis of modern capitalism is like slave labor, like really just like the selling and trading of these slaves. Like there are fucking like huge corporations that are still like you know caking off that slave money and shit like that.
The entire country.
Right. So until y'all motherfuckers are ready to talk about what y'all owe me, whether the number 7 trillion or 8 trillion or 9 trillion, at the very fucking least, y'all owe me the right to my fucking identity and to not exploit that shit. You get what I'm saying? Like, that's all we're, like, holding on to, like, hip-hop and rap and, like, Bill Cosby or whatever the fuck it is. Like, that shit is fucking, like, too timely. That's too timely that, like, you have, like, Eric Garner and Mike Brown and, like,
and then Trayvon they throw Martin Bill Cosby's
and y'all fucking
old
talking
story
about Bill Cosby. Like, what the fuck? What does that have to do with any? Y'all putting that shit on like TV for the kids to see, like for the youth to fucking see. You know, when it's happening like back to back to back to back to back, and I get it, you know, it's like, all right, whatever, like, you know, we're gonna march, we're gonna do this, but like, no, we really have to talk about this.
All right, so there's a lot here to kind of like, I think, to parse, you know, with respect to some of the things that she's talking about here. But I'm just going to delve in and kind of like give my thoughts on this. And you guys can, you know, share your thoughts on Twitter, on Facebook, you know, hit me up, you know, on my page and let me know what you think. But one, I think that she does have a point here. There are two things, there are two sides to this story. I think one, when you look at in this country, all forms of American music is all forms of American music is black music. The most popular forms of black music, platforms of music, should I say. Originally, you know, even country music owes a lot of to what it is, particularly some of the older forms of country music owes its prevalence to blues. You know, and then from blues, African-American came out of the African-American community during the 30s, 40s and 50s was jazz music. And early on, as jazz music began to progress, there became from the industry as it was at the time, you know, there became this big rush to put a white face on jazz music. Everything, you know, a lot of the time, what began to be called big band music was kind of like popularized jazz music. So you had, band leaders, composers, I guess, like Benny Goodman, who were huge, huge fans of jazz music, but didn't necessarily always were proponents of black jazz artists. And so now, if you look at jazz now, jazz pretty much in this country is dead. But you can go all around the world, even to as far as Japan and China, and jazz music still holds, and Germany as well. Still, jazz music still holds true as a very strong and popular music form. However, the faces a lot of times of the jazz musicians are not people from the African American community, and so. I think she has a point that once sometimes it seems like a, you know, something that something once it leaves a particular culture, it no longer looks like the culture, and the people who are purveyors of it are not people from that culture as well. As quiet as it kept for a lot of people don't understand or don't know this, particularly people in the millennial group, that rock and roll music is a black form of music, and it owes its birth in blues again. Early forms of rock and roll tunes by white artists, they would actually take blues songs and change the tempo of them. And so you had individuals who grew up in blues, singing blues, playing blues earlier in their careers. By the time rock and roll began to be a thing, so to speak, people like Chuck Berry, people like Fats Domino, people like Little Richard, people like James Brown, the hardest working man in the country. They realized early that they had to work hard at their craft. And so eventually, you know, rock and roll, the face of rock and roll, even to this day, I can remember when Elvis Presley's birthday, I think was maybe a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago. And everyone in this Twitter sphere and Facebook was, you know, long live the king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley, blah, blah, blah. And Elvis Presley, even at one point early in his career, when he was a little bit more honest about who he is, who he was with respect to rock and roll, you know, said he went to black blues clubs, black music clubs throughout the South. And he watched, black musicians play, and he literally stole the music from them. He stole their craft from them. He stole what they did on stage, and he took it and turned it into a form that he was able to benefit and profit from, as well as the industry off of him. And so eventually, here we are fast for today. If a black person is involved in rock and roll, you almost everybody looks kind of like, you know, like kind of cross-eyed, like, what is this? Why is he doing, why is she doing rock and roll music? Why aren't they doing hip hop? Why aren't they doing R&B? Why aren't they doing gospel? Why aren't they doing blues? Because it's looked at this is not a form of music that black people do, because this is not something that comes from black people, when it couldn't be much more further from the truth. And then with hip hop, of course, you know, the newest child. And the only thing I can say from this, from my perspective on this, is that, you know, at one point hip hop wanted to be mainstream. And sometimes once you get what you ask for, it may not necessarily be exactly what you wanted in the first place, from the standpoint that you have, you know, they wanted to be mainstream and they want to be accepted by mainstream culture, being the white culture. Well, when it did, you know, it began to become a form of, another form of music from the community that could be monetized. And that's the problem I think she ultimately has, that it's being monetized and the face, literally the face of it, is being changed. And so we have a female in Iggy Azalea, who by many standards is not an interesting artist, but she's a great performer. She can't really rap, and she's an individual from Australia, and she's an individual who seems to basically change who she is in order to make a dollar. She's not really, people don't believe she's true to the culture. Despite the fact that, of course, you know, a person like Macklemore, who for almost a decade was underground before he actually got any type of mainstream notoriety, any type of mainstream play, I think a lot of people had a problem with him ultimately because he supported, you know, same-sex marriage. And a lot of people felt that doesn't fit within the culture of hip hop, because, of course, all black people think the same. And there are plenty of black people who have same-sex relatives who don't give a damn about, you know, them being given married. They look at it just simply them being having the opportunity to do what they can with the one they love, the same opportunity they have as, heterosexual people. But I do think she has a point here, and that it is this kind of like fuck you ultimately to black people in general, that, you know, we're still not looked at as true citizens. You know, you'll still get people when you get in discussions, heated discussion on any type of racial issue, and we're not the only ones, but that's the topic right now. You hear people, particularly you hear white people say, well, go back to Africa. And that's always really, really funny to me, because when they get into arguments with other people, they don't say go back to Ireland. They don't say go back to Germany. They don't say go back to Israel. They don't say go back to Iraq. They don't say go back to Russia. All the other ethnic groups that exist in this country, European, you know, they don't say go back to Italy or France. All these others that exist in this country. But they always seem to find a way to say, tell us to go back someplace, when in fact, you know, historically, for the very most of us, our people didn't come here as immigrants. Our people came here as slaves. So we were brought here. So if anybody, if you want to really say that and have that really and have any real meaning, it would be those other groups that came here as immigrants, because you came here voluntarily. And so in a sense, even though I necessarily rock with this perspective, if you don't like what it is, then go back to where you came from. Not so much with, you know, African-Americans, not so much Native American people, because we, you know, they were here and we were brought here. So in one hand, more than any other group, we've earned our right to be here more than any other group, those who have come here of their own volition. And so, you know, I think, you know, her perspective is kind of spot on. And even when it comes to film, we look at what's happening recently with films like, a couple of years ago, we had a film done by director M. Night Shyamalan that was called The Last Airbender, based off animation series. It wasn't based off black, but it was kind of shows you what America does a lot of time, particularly white America and money, white money in this country, in the film industry. You know, M. Night Shyamalan, for whatever reason, he changed all the main characters who are from an Asian culture. He changed all of them to be, you know, white individuals. So people called it a whitewashing, and the film was not done well. And it was basically a box office flop, because there was a lot of political fallout from what he did with that particular property. And what he didn't know is that that was has been a very successful and huge property. This is something that has happened recently with the movie Exodus, another film that was based in black culture, ancient Egypt. And all of the main characters for that movie are white. And there was another fallout. The film didn't do well again. A lot of fallout across the nation, and even reached kind of like the shot heard around the world, where you had the country of Egypt and the country of Morocco ban that film from being shown because they felt it was too historically incorrect, and there was just a great deal of disapproval of basically whitewashing, you know, the characters in order to, as you know, the director of the movie, Ridley Scott, said, to make it sellable, which is kind of weird because there was a time, particularly in the late 80s and 90s, when the biggest thing out of Hollywood was a black man by the name of Charlie Murphy. And overseas, the numbers show that Denzel Washington sells better than Russell Crowe. So it's kind of like that, you know, on one hand, you say you couldn't sell the film because we had black faces, but then you have black faces who sell very well overseas. And there is a market overseas. You know, you have places like Nollywood and Bollywood that are huge, and all those people are people of color. But, you know, these are the kinds of things I think that a lot of times people don't like to discuss in this country because it makes people, certain people, feel uncomfortable. And for a full disclosure, the Avatar, Avatar, the movie and the film is based off of, I said Disney, but I meant to say Nickelodeon. These are the kinds of things, you know, that really play into the fact that maybe we're not quite the post-racial society that this country wants the world to believe and wants to sell to, you know, the citizens of this country. We're not quite there yet. Especially, you have, you know, on the heels of all of the non-indictments of white police officers who have shot black citizens in very questionable situations. And so it is, so this cultural smudging of African-American culture and African-American contributions to the greater culture of the United States is very real. And it's an issue that hasn't gone anywhere. And my suspicion is that as we try to move towards this so-called post-racial society, we're going to have to deal with these things. We're going to have to talk about these things, and we're going to have to tell all the children in this country the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So anyway, again, I thank you so much for tuning in, paying attention, giving me your time, because, again, I know that you could have spent this someplace else. You could have been listening to someone else, but you chose to listen to my little simple podcast and delve into the corner of my mind. Talk to you later, and thanks for tuning in.
My way not be your way, but it's okay, it's alright. Your way might not be my way, but it's okay, it's alright.
Yeah, I used to go to church, but the church didn't quench my thirst. Mama taught me to put God first, but she never tried to block my search. I was curious, young but serious. Why is religion so mysterious? Why is black life so hard? They say you're not supposed to question God. Well, is it okay to question the pastor? Was it passed down from the slave master? It was only the truth I was after, but I never could get a straight answer, so I couldn't relate to the sermon. Put down the Bible, then I start learning about life. Didn't know where the path would lead, but I had to get off my knees.